Hello and welcome to Into the Wild, the podcast that brings you animal facts, wildlife updates and nature stories from the professionals to you. I love chatting about wildlife, but one part I enjoy even more is chatting about wildlife I don't know much about. And this week I spoke with Sean McCann, a biologist across the Atlantic in Nova Scotia, Canada, who works in the field getting up close and personal with the native wildlife. From the animals of Nova Scotia themselves and the threats they are facing, to Sean's latest project, which is beach spider surveying, we covered many topics about wildlife, nature and sustainability. It's very easy to get trapped in a UK bubble, so when talking about environmental movements in Canada, it was exciting to hear what is happening and what different priorities there are compared to life here in the UK. Thanks so much for tuning in and enjoy the show. You're actually my first international guest. That's quite exciting.
International, transcontinental.
I've just realised today as I was planning for the podcast, I was like, wait a minute, Sean's the first person not in the UK that I'm going to interview. This is really exciting. How are you? How's your day been? You all good?
Being in lockdown, we're getting a bit zoomed out. We've had so many meetings and things like that, maybe more so than when we're actually in the laboratory working. But yeah, and everybody comes up with projects. They're like, you know, we're all locked out. Let's come up with something innovative. And that's just happened again and again. And so we've been collaborating much more so than we would otherwise if we had our own lab work to do.
Yeah, that's true, I guess. Isn't it funny that like Zoom at the beginning of lockdown was this exciting thing where people that weren't usually using it, maybe that were really excited. And I think now 14 weeks later, we're like, oh, we don't care about Zoom anymore. Just leave me alone.
Yeah, well, I mean, you try to have fun with it, you know, bring your pets into the picture. I like to clip a macro lens onto the camera that we're using and show people the spiders that I have here in the room. And
that's amazing. Yeah. Oh, that's really cool.
Actually, I'm going to be doing that tomorrow with a school group from Whistler, British Columbia, where we're going to be showing them some live spiders as well as talking about spider biology.
Oh my God, that's amazing.
Yeah, it's if you have a Canon EOS DSLR, they have an application, and I think a lot of the other manufacturers now, where you can use your SLR as a webcam. So if you have a macro lens or a clip-on macro diopter, you can show people quite small things very effectively.
Yeah, that's so cool, and what a great thing to use it for as well in this current time of stuff like that. That's really cool.
Yeah, and I like just having better image quality than anybody else on the call as well.
It's, it's always a competition, isn't it? It always is on Zoom. It's like, I've got to be the best one here. Well, thanks so much for joining me on today's show. I'm really excited. I've been looking forward to chatting to you. Just for the benefit of the listeners around the world for the show, could you tell us who you are and what is it you do?
Well, yeah, my name is Sean McCann. I'm a biologist here in Nova Scotia, Canada, and I study animal behavior of all kinds. Like, I have very broad interests. If it's an animal and it behaves, I'm usually pretty interested in it. But specifically, my research focus is chemical ecology. So these are the interactions animals have with chemicals they either produce or chemicals in the environment, things that they smell to find food or mates, and basically looking at how animals use chemicals in their daily lives.
Oh, that's amazing. Is that a certain type of animal? Is it like every animal that uses these chemicals, or is there a certain family of animals?
It's primarily been insects that have, you know, been the focus of chemical ecology research, because chemical ecology is used to as pest control. I mean, people exploit pheromones to trap insects or to attract them and kill them. It also so happens that insects are quite easy to study chemical ecology of, because their pheromones are in classes of compounds that are pretty easy to study in a gas chromatograph. But, you know, lots of taxa use chemicals. Our dog was just in heat, and it was quite obvious that the pheromones she was producing were quite attractive.
So. Yeah, I think nearly everyone's going to relate to that at some point.
Yeah, that's another consequence of lockdown. She was supposed to be spayed, but, of course, the vet was not accepting these optional treatments.
That was over here as well. I run a dog daycare company, and the amount of dogs we've had that were ready to have the procedure, I'll call it, and that have had to hold off for a bit longer. So it's been quite interesting dealing with these dogs going, oh, you were ready 4 months ago.
Well, as a student of animal behavior, of course, it's really interesting. It's just you have such an emotional connection with your dog that having her go through her teenage angst it's a little closer to home. You feel for her, but you're also getting exasperated with her her aggression and her willingness to hump everything in sight.
That's what it comes down to, isn't it? That's the last bit. It's like aggression I can deal with, being a bit of a knob, but don't hump me or hump stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the line in the sand. So let's ask this question. This is one of my favourite questions I always get to ask everyone, and the answers are always different. But how and where did your thirst for nature and wildlife begin for you?
Oh, it's really difficult to answer that because I don't actually remember too well, but I do know that even before I could talk, as soon as I could walk around, that, you know, my mom would send me out in the backyard with a spoon to dig in the soil, and I would fill up a cup with earthworms or beetles or something like that. That was always my favorite thing to do, turning over logs and seeing what creatures I could find. And it's just been a constant through my life, you know. Then got older and learned to read and consume media like that. I got really into snakes. Thought I wanted to be a herpetologist, but that's been more difficult than I anticipated. And, you know, since that time, I've just been fascinated with animals from a very young age. I've been very into raptors and more recently, of course, insects and other arthropods like spiders, just in the way that my career has shaped up.
Yeah. Is that something that you find when you say, like, you know, you had that interest in snakes and then you've developed an interest in raptors and then later on a further interest in insects? Is that your career pushing you in that direction? Is that something your interest is naturally just kind of fluiding through to different animals? Or is there something about the animals that will go, oh, I haven't learned this before, and you go into that?
Yeah. Basically, I become fascinated by a topic and I just kind of pursue it as far as I can. And in some ways, you know, the realities of the job market have dictated where I've gone. It's hard to find work as either a herpetologist or a raptor specialist, although the jobs do exist. There's more call for entomologists because of the practical implications of insects as pests and things like that. Plus, when you look at animals and life on Earth, I mean, most animals are insects. So, most known organisms are insects. So, if you say you like animals and you don't like insects, well, you're missing out on the majority of species. So,
oh, what a great way to look at it! That is such a one. I've never had anyone word it like that, and I'm going to reply that to people so often if they say I like animals but I don't like insects. It's like, well, you've just thrown away a lot of animals.
Yeah.
And that's such a good way of looking at it. So this show is, it's kind of naturally just been focused on UK wildlife. All my previous guests on the show have been UK-based in the nature industry, even if they've studied animals abroad, but it usually comes down to talking about UK wildlife. But what I'm excited to talk to you about today is Canadian wildlife, because like you said, you're there in Nova Scotia. What kind of wildlife diversity do you have around you in Nova Scotia?
Well, you see, Nova Scotia has been subject to European colonization for around about 300 years or so. So in reality, it's a set of ecosystems that have suffered a lot of effects of that, you know, intensive agriculture, logging, mining, urbanization, things to that effect. So if you compare Nova Scotia as a whole to the rest of boreal Canada, especially further west, you've got a more limited set of environments that have been highly altered by humanity. But if you would, you know, compare over to the UK, which is, you know, it is Europe and has been subject to intense agriculture for, you know, well over 1,000 years, Yeah, it's got quite a bit of wildlife. We still have moose here. The wolves have been extirpated from Nova Scotia.
Oh, really?
As have puma. I mean, these are large predators that used to exist. And off the coastline, of course, the gray whales were subject to massive, you know, whaling and depopulation via that. So it's a changed environment, but there's still lots of stuff to see. I mean, some positive notes, I guess, are like we see eagles daily here.
Oh, wow.
And so they've recovered quite nicely from the use of synthetic pesticides in the 1960s and 70s. So yeah, you do see some signs of hope. But yeah, we're just getting to know the diversity of life around here. We're from the West Coast, Catherine and I, and we getting to know a new environment. It has been exciting.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's when you said about the wolves and the puma that have since left the area, is that through a hunting, or is that kind of as their prey has dropped down more as well?
Mostly direct persecution of predators, yeah. Bounties and just over hunting and things like that. In some respects, some of the prey base has been depleted. Like, for instance, here in what we call mainland Nova Scotia, that is everything except Cape Breton Island, the moose population has been crashing and is, in fact, considered threatened. So the prey base that would support wolf packs has been depleted quite considerably. But, you know, given lucky reintroduction, I'm sure that they could take hold again.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Do you have a favourite animal? Because did you say you're originally from the west of Canada?
Yeah.
So do you have
a favourite animal?
Do you have a favourite animal that you now see in Nova Scotia that you see around there? You said about the eagles being around there, which must be incredible to see. But is there something that you love to see when you go outside?
Oh, well, we have merlins that are nesting here.
Oh, wow.
They're quite exciting.
Yeah.
Just because they're so fast and so vocal.
Yeah.
And they're generally screaming at some other bird, you know, or chasing them or whatever it happens to be. That's pretty exciting. Plus, now that it's early summer, every time we take the dog out for a walk, we're seeing new spiders that are new to us and insects.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to talking about the spiders a little bit later on. I've got some questions faced for that. I've seen your new project that started. I'm really excited about talking about that. We spoke about a little bit there about some of the threats that wildlife is facing in Nova Scotia. What about the rest of Canada? Obviously, I focus a lot on the UK wildlife and native wildlife here, but is it the similar side threats where we're looking at in Canada, like deforestation and clearing of land for urbanisation and things like that?
Yeah, to some extent, especially in southern Canada, where most of the population is, urbanization is a big threat to wildlife habitat, especially because, you know, a lot of our species diversity is concentrated in the very southern belt that borders the United States. But regionally, like, you can point to threats like, I mentioned the whales off Nova Scotia. They're under threat in a continued way due to not only pollutants in the St. Lawrence Seaway, but also ship collisions from the heavy shipping industry that moves through that body of water. In Western Canada, you have things like the oil sands development in Alberta that's responsible for a massive habitat destruction and loss. And into BC, you have industrial scale logging and large mining operations that also remove a lot of habitat. But of course, you know, worldwide, of course, we're seeing the effects of climate change as well, which many, you know, scientists agree is one of the greatest threats to biodiversity that we have. But you can look at, you know, threats to wildlife at many different scales. And the ones that people can become more familiar with in their local area are often, you know, the loss of wooded areas, the loss of parklands. These are all going to affect the species they see day to day.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's one of the things we're seeing over here, especially. What kind of things are you seeing happening in Canada to challenge these threats to wildlife? Is there things being done? Is it kind of something, or is it something that a lot of animal organizations going, come on, we should be acting a bit faster? Or
there is there is some momentum worldwide placed on the climate change crisis. And that's good, but it can often feel somewhat distant. What encourages me is seeing local movements to protect and enhance wildlife habitat nearer to home.
Yeah.
So, for instance, the province of Nova Scotia recently delisted a provincial park, the Owl's Head Provincial Park, and basically sold it to a developer who was going to build a golf course, which sounds very Donald Trump-like, but it's, and of course, like, rightly so, the populace here was quite enraged by this,
yeah.
And they've since backtracked on that, and I think they're going to relist it as protected parkland.
Good.
This is a habitat I've never been to, but from what I've seen, it seems to be quite a unique set of landforms.
Yeah, and I think that's what you've said there, that kind of tale, that's something we've seen a lot more here in the UK. We've seen a huge wave of wildlife and environmental support from everyone, but specifically the youth. Obviously,
yeah.
We've got Greta Thunberg pushing that protest and keeping that voice alive, which is essential. But from, like you said, from a local community point of view, I've seen
yeah.
it where I live in the area of London, people standing up saying, no, protect this or support this or this shouldn't happen. Even from during lockdown, you know, we've got areas of green lawn around my housing estate where we've asked the council to not mow it, keep it wild
yeah.
for a bit, keep it a bit longer. And that's the first time, you know, in the 6 years I've lived around here, that's ever happened. Have you seen a similar wave of kind of motivation in Canada, specifically in the youth as well?
Well, I hope to. To some extent, this, the proliferation of social media is allowing these messages to get out there and spread. And, protection of green verges and things by roadsides it seems to be gaining some traction.
Yeah.
What I like about when people undertake these types of, becoming aware of habitat in their area is that they can feel empowered, that they can actually do something.
Mm.
And so, working on these smaller fights might give them the motivation to take on larger topics
yeah.
and feel that they have a voice.
Yeah, I think that's it. I think that's, you've hit the nail on the head there for me. I think it's more, we need people doing the local stuff. And if all communities have people doing the local stuff, really the bigger picture is being solved as well.
Yeah, or at least then you have a community of like-minded people who are,
yeah.
Aware of the issues, aware of their power to impact them and band together and push for change.
Mm. The other thing we've seen in the UK, and I'm interested to see if this is also happening over in Canada and places like that as well, is a huge push for waste reduction. Looking at refilling bottles, not using plastics, loose fruit and veg, really going back to kind of how life was in 50s and 60s in UK, really, which was,
yeah.
packaging cost money.
Yeah,
you couldn't afford packaging, so you never had it. And that's kind of what, we're trying to push back to. Again, we're, especially in London, I guess I'm in a bubble here, but we've got the refill stations of the shops where you can go and refill your laundry detergent, your washing up liquid and stuff like that. Is that something else that's starting to pop up over there as well?
It's not as common in rural Nova Scotia. I've seen similar stuff in Vancouver when I lived there, but in rural Nova Scotia, you have shopping that's limited to some, large grocers and big box stores for the most part.
Yeah.
There are, of course, farmers markets that people take advantage of here, where packaging is often you bring your own and they'll fill it up for you, kind of thing.
Yeah.
Which is nice. But in terms of waste reduction and disposal, Nova Scotia's had to adapt to a pretty harsh regime of recycling because basically the economy of this province is not doing terribly hot, and the disposal costs that they were having for landfills and such were so great that they really had to aggressively adopt recycling in a big way.
Oh, wow.
Especially composting of organics and diversion of plastic waste and things to that effect. So I'd say, in fact, that compared to British Columbia, that Nova Scotia has much more aggressive policies for reducing that sort of waste.
When you said the composting there, do you mean from a domestic level, from just people's homes doing it at home, or is that
at home and in some industrial processes, agriculture and stuff like that? I'm actually involved in a project now where we're looking at it's an idea that's taken off, is using black soldier fly as waste remediators, basically taking organic inputs from the brewing industry, the agriculture industry, and using black soldier fly maggots to decompose the waste and produce these high protein, you know, pupae that can then be sold as animal feed or other, you know, they're actually even experimenting with using them as human food.
Wow. Yeah, that's incredible. So
the flies, yeah, they're capable, since they're, you know, obligate detritivores, they're decomposers by nature. They're capable of taking really low quality organic inputs and just feeding so heavily and accumulating so much from it that they're, you know, they transform a low quality, you know, protein source into a really concentrated, valuable source. I believe that they're, you know, previously black soldier fly operations have been, you know, marketing primarily to, you know, fish farms and chicken farms and such. But now they're getting into the pet food industry and realizing that you can make very high quality dog and cat foods from them.
This is something that the maggots of the black fly will eat and then kind of release from what they've eaten. So this is like a circle, basically.
Yeah, you're basically you're using these animals they're capturing the usable protein in that waste stream and concentrating it, and you can then take it, you can take the pupae and sell them on, and then what's left over is basically a high quality soil that can be used as a, you know, additive for gardens and farms and stuff.
I mean, I think that's just amazing that that's even being looked at. What kind of level is that being looked on now? Is that still lab, like, work at the moment, or is this actually being instigated?
It's an industrial production. There are some big companies in Canada that are doing it and some smaller startups. And it seems to be a worldwide thing, too. What you've got is this, it's basically a tropical fly, but with, you know, greenhouse technology, you can perpetuate it in almost any climate.
Yeah.
As long as it's protected. And it's kind of analogous to using worms for composting, but these are capable of doing so very quickly because they're kept at higher temperatures. And
yeah, that's, I mean, that kind of, this whole point, everything we've just said there kind of takes us back to the very beginning of the show when we just said kind of how important insects are. We were saying about liking insects, you know, if you're an animal lover and or whatever, and then people saying that they don't, and then we're looking at something like this, that insects are massively helping or can be used to help solve a very big and important problem.
Well, insects are they're powerful. I mean, one thing that has lost a lot of attention in this time of the COVID-19 epidemic is there's also a resurgent epidemic of you know, desert locust out in Africa that has been, you know, sweeping through quite a number of countries.
Really?
I don't know if you're aware of migratory locusts and how they can basically destroy an entire country's agricultural output for the duration that they're infesting. So.
Oh, wow. And that's been going through since COVID.
Yeah, I mean, it hasn't gained as much attention, but I'm sure the FAO and other international agencies are monitoring it quite closely. But there's an example of insects that are unstoppable, and what little we can do against them is painfully apparent.
Yeah, God, absolutely. And whilst we're talking about insects, I'm really excited to go on to this project that you've recently started. You said you've been doing a bit of field work today with this, and I'm so excited because I love spiders. terrified of them on some level. I don't know why. It's just that instilled fear that is put upon us as children on every kind of media and everything. But I do, I absolutely love them. So I'm excited to learn about this. You've started a project focused on beach spiders, which sounds like the most laid back of all the insects. Can you tell us a bit more about this project? What is this? What does this involve?
Well, basically, we envisioned it as a way of getting out in the environment and getting to know the fauna here of Nova Scotia. Catherine and I, my partner, Catherine, she's the arachnologist in the family. I'm just the amateur.
I love that. I love the way you have one in the family. That's such a wonderful way to say that.
But anyway, since we do have experience from years of doing field work on black widow spiders and beaches in the west coast of Canada, we figured, you know, what a good thing it would be to be able to compare what we know from there with what's happening here in the Atlantic coast. So, we targeted sand dune ecosystems, which, according to habitat inventories, are one of the most critically imperiled habitat types in Nova Scotia due to coastal development and things to that effect. Basically, it's just a baseline survey of spider and ant diversity, and we picked those two because Catherine's pretty good with the spider identification, and I'm pretty good with the ant identification.
Nice.
But you can pick any taxon you want. We'll also produce bycatch that will include other taxa of interest. This is basic biodiversity inventory stuff, and it's quite modest. It's not a ton of money, it's not a ton of time, but this type of research where you're just surveying and inventorying is critical to do to have a point of comparison for other areas or other times. So
absolutely. I guess data from any project, no matter how grand or small, is used constantly in comparison or just to monitor, isn't it?
And in addition, we're also trying to take habitus photos. So basically photos of the living animals, of those that we hand collect. So that the general appearance of the living spider can be associated with a known species identification.
Cool.
Plus, you know, the museum will be given all this stuff, will be given all the photos as well as the specimens, and they can use the photos for, you know, outreach and educational purposes.
Yeah, which is absolutely huge. And one thing when I saw the project in my head, I don't know why, I'm trying to remember back. Have I even seen a spider on the beach? I don't even know if I have, but I'm very ignorant here, but when I think of spiders, obviously you don't think of a beach environment. So how have they adapted to live in this? How are their lives different if we compare them to kind of forest spiders or woodland spiders and things like that?
Well, since there's not as much vegetation, they're generally ground hunting spiders. So things like wolf spiders and jumping spiders are often found on beaches. There is, of course, in dune vegetation, there's your standard orb weavers and things to that effect. And, you know, higher up where there's driftwood and things like that, there's... On the West Coast, there's black widows and other web builders like that. But beaches in general are a rich habitat. It's an interface between the ocean and the land. And so you get a lot of wolf spiders and jumping spiders that are coming down to the high tide line where there's a lot of decaying kelp and other organic matter from the ocean, which are, you know, then fed upon by flies and crustaceans like amphipods. And that's a rich prey source that these spiders can exploit.
Yeah, of course.
So, there are some what might be called shoreline specialist species. We're particularly interested in these fairly robust wolf spiders, Arctosa literalis and its relatives. So its name, literalis, you might imagine, is they're associated with shorelines. Basically, to see these types of things, since they stay in a burrow throughout the day, you go out at night with headlamps and you can see their eyes glowing.
Oh wow.
Yeah, the beach at night is a very different place than in the daytime,
because just all these glowing eyes looking at you, just not usually what you see. You're into your birds as well. You're a big fan of birds. Specifically, you mentioned to me as we were planning the episode, you're a fan of red-throated caracaras. Is that correct?
Yeah, the red-throated caracara. Yeah, that's the bird that I did my PhD thesis on. It's a type of falcon, but it's not what you would, you know, imagine if you say the word falcon. Caracaras are not like falcons at all. They're broad-winged, slow-flying, highly vocal, often scavengers, often, you know, opportunistic predators of things on the ground. Mm. But this particular species, the red-throated caracara, you can find it in the Amazonian forest region and some adjacent tropical forest regions in Central and South America, is a specialist predator on social wasps.
Okay.
So as an insect chemical ecologist, that's where I was going with that research, is trying to look at their chemical relations with the wasps. In fact, studying a hypothesis that they possessed some sort of wasp repellent that protected them from their prey.
Sorry. Apparently that's the noise I make when I've realized something. So was the theory that they actually had kind of a protection barrier around them from the wasp, or a repellent, like you said.
Yeah, we found out that wasn't the case. So there was that, you know, that's why I haven't published in Nature or Science. We found, in fact, that they're exploiting the behavior of the wasps in order to prey on them successfully by, basically, it's analogous to, you know, if you turned over a honeybee hive and scattered it, all those bees would fly off and start a new hive elsewhere rather than just continue defending that destroyed one.
I did not know that.
That's called it's called absconding behavior.
Mm.
And some of the wasps that the caracaras are feeding on, you can induce this absconding behavior by damaging their nests sufficiently. So
they can damage the nest, and the wasps will more likely move on to make a new nest rather than to defend.
Basically, they'll defend as long as it's a fruitful strategy, but if it appears likely that their nest will not, you know, cease being attacked by the birds, then they'll decide, we'll sacrifice, you know, the larvae that we have in that nest and go start a new one where we can't be found.
I mean, that's an incredibly good plan.
Yeah. But when you have a year-round nest in the tropics, I mean, often, you know, bad stuff happens.
Yeah, very
true. A tree might fall on you, or army ants might come upon your nest, and so it makes sense to have a strategy to deal with catastrophe.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess it's something, especially in the wasp world, we don't really consider that to have ever been an option. You know, there's that thought of wasps always being the attack, 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 defend, defend. So actually know that, you know, there's this kind of weighing up the options, especially from a nest point of view. That's an amazing bit of information. I didn't know that at all.
Yeah, from a European perspective, there's an equivalent bird called the honey buzzard that you have comes to England in the summertime to breed. It has a similar type of diet. They feed on wasps and bees primarily. But I don't know that the same strategy holds for them. They, in fact, have, like, physical adaptations to protect them from wasps. They have, like, really dense plumage that's really tough. And, in addition, I mean, some of the wasps that they're feeding on, especially in the temperate climates, they don't give up. The wasps that start with a single foundress and develop through the summer, like your yellow jackets and things like that, they don't have this evolved strategy of absconding. They're unable to fly off and start a new nest. So they'll keep defending until the bitter end, kind of thing.
Yeah, tell me about it. You do not bat away a yellow jacket in the UK if you don't want to spend the next hour batting away a yellow jacket in the UK.
Yeah.
Kind of what you're faced with. Every first dinner outside in the UK, you deal with a yellow jacket. It's just the law.
Yeah.
This is a question I ask all my guests to round off. And it's quite a hard question, but if you could just pass on one bit of advice to everyone in regards to the natural world and wildlife, what would you pass on?
Oh, that is a bit of a tough one. I'd say, you know, do yourself a favor and take time and get out and explore the natural world if you can. It's one of the, you know, being a photographer and stuff, you can always lust after a new camera or a new piece of gear, but the most precious resource is, in fact, the time and the mental energy to get out there and see what there is to see. And, rather than scheduling another 10 Zoom meetings, maybe a walk in the park or by the seaside would be a better use of your time.
I completely agree. Heartfelt with that. That's perfect. Sean, thanks so much for joining me on this episode. And good luck with the rest of your projects, your numerous projects that you're working on. And I kind of want to say, are you posting pictures on Twitter of spiders that you're finding?
Yes. Yeah, we're going to try to do that under the hashtag BeachSpidersNF.
Nice. Okay. Well, I am going to be following that hashtag because I'm really intrigued to see the pictures you're getting. Good luck with everything. And thanks so much for joining me on the show.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks again for listening. If you'd like to keep up to date with the projects and shows that Sean is working on, you can do so on Twitter at IBYCTER. I'm not going to try and pronounce that because that is in Latin. Don't forget to subscribe to us on iTunes, Podbean and Spotify. You can also get in touch on social media at Into the Wild Pod, whether it's just to say hello, share some thoughts on an episode, or even let me know what you'd like to hear about next. Until next time, keep well, stay safe and live the good life.